at the doorway and said,
"Me and Thunderstick decided to take our show to college," Hassan said, and Colin opened his mouth to talk, but Hassan said, "I only registered for 2 classes in the fall, so don't start creaming yourself. I've got to ease my way into it. Don't tell me how fucking happy you are. I know."
And sure enough, that September 9th, Hassan would sit down in a class called English Composition at 10 in the morning, even though it directly conflicted with his beloved companion, friend, and possible fantasy lover, Judge Judy. Chapter 18. Colin slept through the rooster that Thursday morning, but not through Lindsay jumping onto his bed and saying,
"Get up, we're going to Memphis."
She gracefully jumped down, her butt landing on the bed, and sang,
"Memphis, Memphis, we're skipping work and going to Memphis to spy on Hollis and find out why she was filling the swear jar."
"Mm-hmm," Colin mumbled as if he were sleepy, but he wasn't. Her presence made him shoot immediately awake. When Colin got downstairs, Hassan was up and dressed and fed. With a few days of healing, his face had returned mostly to normal. He was searching through a mess of papers.
"Kafir," he said loudly, "help me find the warehouse's address. I'm lost in a sea of spreadsheets."
It took Colin about 30 seconds to find the address of the warehouse in Memphis. He found it at the top of a business letter addressed to Gutshot Textiles, Inc. Hassan shouted,
"MapQuest 2246 Trial Boulevard, Memphis, Tennessee, 37501.
And Lindsay Lee Wells shouted back,
"Awesome! Good work, Hassan."
"Well, technically, it was my work," Colin noted.
"Let me take the credit. I've had a tough week," Hassan said as he collapsed dramatically on the couch. "Hey, how do you like that, Singleton? You're the only non-recent dumpy in this house."
This was true, but Hassan seemed to get over Katrina immediately, and Lindsay had just burst into Colin's room in song, so he still felt he could lay claim to the household's most devastated dumpy, even if he had to admit that he didn't exactly want K-19 back anymore. He wanted her to call, he wanted her to miss him, but as it turned out, he was okay. He'd never found single life so interesting before. Hassan called driving, and Lindsay called shotgun, so even though it was his car, Colin was relegated to the back seat, where he curled up against the window and read J.D. Salinger's Seymour, An Introduction. He finished it just as the Memphis skyline came into view. It was no Chicago, but Colin had missed skyscrapers. They drove through downtown and then got off the interstate in a part of the city that seemed to be comprised entirely of low-lying buildings, with few windows and even fewer signs informing visitors of their function. A few blocks from the exit, Lindsay motioned to one, and Hassan pulled into a 4-car parking lot, which was empty.
"You sure this is it?"
"It's the address you found," Lindsay answered. They walked into a small office with a receptionist's desk, which contained no receptionist, so they left and made their way around the side of the warehouse. It was a hot day, but windy enough to feel mild. Colin heard a rumbling, looked up, and saw a bulldozer out in a dirt field behind the warehouse. The only two guys in sight were the guy driving the bulldozer and the fellow behind him who was driving a forklift. The forklift contained 3 massive cardboard boxes. Colin frowned.
"Do you see Hollis anywhere?" Lindsay whispered.
"No."
"Go ask those guys if they've ever heard of Gutshot Textiles," Lindsay said.
Colin didn't particularly enjoy talking to strangers driving forklifts, but he silently walked out into the field. The bulldozer hauled up a final mound of dirt and then puttered away to make room for the forklift. And as it approached the hole, Colin did too. He was spitting distance from the hole when the forklift came to a stop, and the guy came around, reached up, and toppled the first box into the ground. It landed with a thud. Colin kept walking. By the way, the world record for watermelon seed spitting is held by Jim Dietz, who in 1978 spit a watermelon seed 68 feet 11 inches. Colin was closer to the hole than that, for sure.
"How you?"
asked the man, a short black guy with white hair at his temples.
"Okay," said Colin. "Do you work for Gutshot Textiles?"
"Yep."
"What you throwing in the hole?"
"Don't know if that's any of your business on account of you don't own the hole."
Colin didn't really have a response to that. It wasn't his hole. The wind picked up then, and the dried dirt whipped up from the ground and passed over them in a cloud. Colin turned 180 degrees to put his back to the dust, and then he saw Hassan and Lindsay walking briskly toward him. Colin heard the crash of another box, but he didn't want to turn around. He didn't want that dust in his eyes. But then he did turn, because it wasn't only dust flying. The second box had cracked open, and thousands of finely braided tampon strings were whipping past him, and past Hassan and Lindsay, blowing around and over them. And he looked up and watched the strings rush by as he became immersed in a cloud of them. They looked like garfish or brilliant white light. Colin thought of Einstein. A certifiable genius who was definitely never a prodigy, Einstein had figured out that light can act, in a seeming paradox, both as a discrete particle and as a wave. Colin had never understood this before, but now thousands of strings were fluttering over and around and past him, and they were both tiny broken beams of light and endless undulating waves. He reached up to grab one and came down with several, and they kept coming, washing over him, floating all around him. Never have tampon strings seemed so beautiful as they rolled up and down with the wind, landing on the ground and then twirling and floating up again, falling and rising and falling and rising.
"Shit," said the man. "Ain't that pretty, though?"
"It sure is," said Lindsay, suddenly beside Colin, the back of her hand touching the back of his. A few straggling strings were still blowing up from the box, but most of the army of unleashed tampon strings were fading into the distance.
"You look just like your mama," the man said to her.
"I wish you wouldn't say that," said Lindsay. "Who are you, by the way?"
"I'm Roy," he said. "I'm the director of operations for Gutshot Textiles. Your mom'll be here soon. Best let her talk to you. Y'all come in with me and get a drink."
They'd wanted to spy on Hollis, not beat her to the warehouse, but Colin figured the element of secrecy was now more or less totally lost. Roy pushed the last box into the hole, and that one held together. Then he reached his thumb and finger into his mouth, issued a piercing whistle, and motioned to the bulldozer, which lumbered to life. They walked back to the unair-conditioned warehouse. Roy told them to sit tight and then returned to the field.
"She's gone nuts," Lindsay said. "Her director of operations is some guy I've never seen, and she's telling him to bury our damned product out behind the warehouse. She's bonkers. What does she want, to run the town into the ground?"
"I don't think so," said Colin. "I mean, I do think she's bonkers, but I don't think she wants to run the..."
"Baby!"
Colin heard from behind him, and he wheeled around and saw Hollis Wells in her trademark Thursday pink pantsuit.
"What are you doing here?"
Hollis asked, not sounding very angry.
"What the hell's wrong with you, Hollis? Have you gone nuts? Who the hell is Roy? And why are you burying everything?"
"Lindsay, baby, the company ain't doing so well."
"Jesus, Hollis, do you stay up all night, every night, trying to figure out how to ruin my life? Sell the land, put the factory out of business, and then the town will die, and then I'll for sure have to leave?"
Hollis scrunched her face up.
"What? Lindsay Lee Wells, no, no! There's no one to buy them, Lindsay. We have one client, Stay Sure, and they buy a quarter of what we can produce. We've lost everything else to companies overseas. Everything."
"Wait, what?" Lindsay asked quietly, although Colin figured she'd heard.
"They stacked up in the warehouse, up and up and up, and it's just gotten worse and worse until it came to this."
And then Lindsay understood.
"You don't want to fire anyone." "That's right, baby. If we cut production down to what we were selling, we'd lose most of our people. It'd kill Gutshot." "Wait, then why the heck did you hire them to do some made-up little job?" Lindsay asked, nodding toward Colin and Hassan. "If we're so broke, I mean." "It's not made up. A generation from now, there might not be a factory, and I want your kids and their kids to know what it was like, what we were like. And I liked them. I thought they'd be good for you. The world ain't gonna stay like you imagine it, sweetheart."
Lindsay took a step toward her mother.
"Now I know why you work at home," she said, "so no one will know what's going on. No one knows?
Just Roy, said Hollis.
And you can't tell anyone. We can go on like this for at least 5 more years, and so that's what we're going to do, Hollis said. And between now and then, I'm going to work like hell to find new ways of making money.
Lindsay put her arms around her mom's waist and pressed her face against her chest.
5 years is a long time, Mom, she said.
It is and it isn't,
Hollis answered, stroking Lindsay's hair.
It is and it isn't. But it's not your fight, it's mine. I'm sorry, sweetie, I know I've been busier than a mom ought to be.
And this, unlike Tok's cheating, was a secret best kept, Colin thought. People don't like to know that 3/4 of their tampon strings are being buried, or that their paychecks have less to do with the company's profitability than its owner's compassion. Hollis and Lindsay ended up riding home together, leaving Colin and Hassan alone in the hearse. They weren't 5 miles outside of Memphis when Hassan said,
I had a, blinding light spiritual awakening.
Colin glanced at him.
Huh? Watch the road, Kafir. It started a few nights ago, actually, so I guess it wasn't that dramatic. At the old folks' home, when you said I was Mr. Funny Pants because I wanted to avoid getting hurt.
No doubt about it, Colin said.
Yeah, well, that's bullshit, and I knew it was bullshit. But then I started wondering exactly why I am Mr. Funny Pants, and I didn't have a very good answer. But then, back there, I started thinking about what Hollis is doing. I mean, she's giving up all her time and her money so people can keep jobs. She's doing something.
Okay, said Colin, not getting it.
And I'm a not-doer. Like, I'm lazy, but I'm also good at not doing things I'm not supposed to do. I never drank or did drugs or hooked up with girls or beat people up or stole anything. I was always good at that, although not so much this particular summer. But then, doing all the stuff here felt weird and wrong, so now I'm back to happily not doing. But I've never been a doer. I never did anything that helped anybody. Even the religious things that involve doing, I don't do. I don't do zakat,
which is giving to the poor, one of the pillars of Islamic faith.
I don't do Ramadan. I'm a total non-doer. I'm just sucking food and water and money out of the world, and all I'm giving back is, hey, I'm really good at not doing. Look at all the bad things I'm not doing. Now I'm going to tell you some jokes.
Colin glanced over and saw Hassan sipping Mountain Dew. Feeling that he should say something, Colin said,
That's a good spiritual revelation. I'm not done yet, fugger. I was just drinking. But anyway, being funny is a way of not doing. Sit around and make jokes and be Mr. Funny Pants and just make fun of everyone else's attempts to do something. Make fun of you when you get back up and try to love yourself another Catherine. Or make fun of Hollis for falling asleep covered in her work every night. Or get on your case for shooting at the hornet's nest when I didn't shoot at all. So, that's it. I'm going to start doing.
Hassan finished his can of Mountain Dew, crumpled it, and dropped it beneath his feet.
See? I just did something. Usually, he said, I would have thrown that shit in the back seat where I wouldn't have to look at it and you'd have to clean it up the next time you had a date with a Catherine. But I'm leaving it here so I remember to pick it up when we get to the Pink Mansion. God, someone should give me a Congressional Medal of Honor for doing.
Colin laughed.
You're still funny, Colin said. And you have been doing stuff. You registered for college. Yeah, I'm getting there. Although, if I'm going to be an all-out, full-on doer,
Hassan noted, faux morose,
I should probably register for 3 classes. It's a hard life, Kafir.
Chapter 19. Lindsay and Hollis beat them home on account of how Colin and Hassan had to stop at the Hardee's for a monster thick burger. As they stood in the Pink Mansion's living room, Hollis said,
Lindsay went to spend the night at her friend Janet's. She was pretty broken up on the car ride home. It's about the boy, I guess.
Hassan nodded and sat down on the sectional couch with her. Colin's brain started working. He had to find an unsuspicious way out of the Pink Mansion as soon as possible, he realized.
Can I do anything to help you? Asked Hassan,
and Hollis brightened and said, "Sure! Sure, you can sit here with me and brainstorm all night if you've got the time." And Hassan said, "Cool." Colin sort of half-coughed and started speaking rapidly. "I may go out for a while. I think I'm going to go camping. I'll probably sit Pinkler out and sleep in the car, but still, I'm going to give it a try."
"What?" asked Hassan, incredulous.
"Camping," Colin said.
"With the pigs and the hornets and the tox and whatnot?"
"Yes, camping," said Colin, and then he tried to give Hassan an extremely meaningful look.
After staring back quizzically for a moment, Hassan's eyes shot open and he said,
"Well, I'm not going with you. As we've learned, I'm an inside cat."
"Keep your phone on," Hollis said. "Do you have a tent?"
"No, but it's pretty out, and I'll just take a sleeping bag if that's all right."
And then, before Hollis could further object, he climbed the stairs two at a time, grabbed his supplies, and headed out. It was early evening, the fields receding into a pink invisibility as they rose back into the horizon. Colin felt his heart slamming in his chest. He wondered if she even wanted to see him. He'd taken sleeping over at Janet's as a hint, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe she really was sleeping at Janet's, whoever that was, which would mean a lot of hiking for naught. After 5 minutes of driving, he reached the fenced-in field that had once been home to Hobbit the horse. He climbed over the tri-logged fence and jogged across the field. Colin, of course, did not believe in running when walking would suffice, but here and now, walking would not. He slowed down, however, as he made his way up the hill, the flashlight a thin and shaky beam of yellow light against the darkening landscape. He kept it directly before him as he picked through bushes and vines and trees, the thick, rotting floor of the forest crunching beneath his feet, reminding him of where we all go. To seed, to ground, and even then he couldn't help but anagram. To ground. Run, Godot. Donor gut. And the magic through which to ground can become donor gut, combined with his newfound feeling that he had, at some recent point, received a donor gut, kept his pace quick. Even as the darkness became so complete that trees and rocks became not objects but mere shadows, he climbed, until finally he reached the stone outcropping. He walked along the rock, his flashlight scanning up and down until the light passed over the crack. He leaned his head in and said, "Lindsay?"
"Christ, I thought you were a bear."
"Quite the opposite. I was just in the neighborhood and thought I'd drop by," he said. He heard her laugh echo through the cave. "But I don't want to impose."
"Come on in," she said,
and he squeezed through the jagged crack and shuffled sideways until he reached the room. She turned on her flashlight. They were blinding each other.
"I thought you might come," she said.
"Well, you told your mom you were sleeping at Janet's."
"Yeah," she said. "It was kind of a code."
Lindsay pointed the light next to her and then drew a line back to Colin, like she was bringing an airplane into the gate. He walked over and she arranged a couple of pillows into a chair, and he sat beside her.
"Out, damn light," she said,
and it was dark again.
"The most upsetting part of it is that I'm not even upset. About Colin, I mean. Because in the end, I just didn't care. About him, about his liking me, about his screwing Katrina, I just don't care." "Hey, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Where?"
"Here, hi."
"Oh, hi."
"So, go on."
"Right, so, I don't know, it was just so easy to dismiss. I keep thinking I'm going to get upset, but it's been 3 days. And I just don't even think about him. Remember when I told you that unlike me, he was real? I don't think he is, actually. I think he's just boring. I'm so pissed off about it because, I mean, I wasted so much of my life with him and then he cheats on me and I'm not even particularly, like, depressed about it."
"I would love to be like that."
"Yeah, except you wouldn't, I don't think. People are supposed to care. It's good that people mean something to you, that you miss people when they're gone. I don't miss Colin at all. I mean, literally. I only ever liked the idea of being his girlfriend, and that is just such a goddamn waste. That's what I realized. That's what I cried about the whole way home. Here's Hollis really doing something for people. I mean, she works all the goddamn time, and now I know it's not for herself. It's for all these fugging people in Sunset Acres who get a pension that pays for their diapers. And it's for everybody at the factory. I used to be an okay person, you know? But now I never do anything for anybody, except retards I don't even give a shit about.
But people still like you. All the oldsters, everybody at the factory.
Right, yeah, but they like me as they remember me, not as I am now. I mean, honestly, Colin, I'm the world's most self-centered person. Are you there?
It just occurred to me that in point of fact, what you just said can't be true because I am the world's most self-centered person.
Huh?
Or maybe we're tied, because I'm the same, right? What did I ever do for anyone?
Didn't you stay behind Hassan and let like 1,000 hornets sting you?
Oh, yeah, there was that. Okay, you're the world's most self-centered person after all, but I'm close.
Come here.
I am here.
More here.
Okay. There?
Yes, better.
So, what do you do about it? How do you fix it?
That's what I was thinking about before you came. I was thinking about your mattering business. I feel like how you matter is defined by the things that matter to you. You matter as much as the things that matter to you do. And I got so backwards trying to make myself matter to him. All this time there were real things to care about, real good people who care about me and this place. It's so easy to get stuck. You just get caught in being something, being special or cool or whatever, to the point where you don't even know why you need it. You just think you do.
You don't even know why you need to be world famous. You just think you do.
Yeah, exactly. We're in the same boat, Colin Singleton. But it didn't really fix the problem, getting popular.
I don't think you can ever fill the empty space with the thing you lost. Like getting Tok to date you doesn't fix the Alpo event. I don't think your missing pieces ever fit inside you again once they go missing. Like Catherine. That's what I realized. If I did get her back somehow, she wouldn't fill the hole that losing her created.
Maybe no girl can fill it.
Right. Being a world-famous theorem creator wouldn't either.
That's what I've been thinking. That maybe life is not about accomplishing some bullshit markers.
Wait. What's funny?
Nothing. It's just, like, I was thinking that your realization is like if a heroin addict suddenly said, you know, maybe instead of always doing more heroin, I should, like, not do heroin.
I think I know who's buried in the Archduke Franz Ferdinand's tomb, and I don't think it's the Archduke.
I knew you'd figure it out. Yeah, I already know. My great-grandfather.
You knew?
Fred N. Dinsenfar, that anagramming bastard. All the old-timers here know. He insisted on it in his will, supposedly. But then, a couple years ago, Hollis had us put up the sign and start giving tours. Now I realize it was probably for the money.
It's funny what people will do to be remembered.
Well, or to be forgotten, because someday no one will know who's really buried there. Already, a lot of kids at school and stuff think the Archduke is really buried here, and I like that. I like knowing one story and having everyone else know another. That's why those tapes we made are going to be so great one day, because they'll tell stories that time has swallowed up or distorted or whatever.
Where'd your hand go?
It's sweaty.
I don't mind. Oh, hi.
Hi. Did I tell you I dumped one of the Catherines? You what? No. I did, apparently, Catherine the Third. I'd just completely misremembered it. I mean, I always assumed that all the things I did remember were true. Huh.
What?
Well, but it's not as good a story if you dumped her. That's how I remember things anyway. I remember stories. I connect the dots, and then out of that comes a story. And the dots that don't fit into the story just slide away, maybe. Like when you spot a constellation. You look up, and you don't see all the stars. All the stars just look like the big fugging random mess that they are. But you want to see shapes. You want to see stories. So you pick them out of the sky.
Hassan told me once you think like that, too, that you see connections everywhere, so you're a natural-born storyteller, it turns out.
I never thought about it like that. It makes sense.
So tell me the story.
What, the whole thing?
Yeah. Romance, adventure, morals, everything.
The beginning, and the middle, and the end. Catherine the First was the daughter of my tutor, Crazy Keith, and she asked me to be her boyfriend one night at my house, and I said yes, and then about 2 minutes and 30 seconds later, she dumped me, which seemed funny at the time, but now, in retrospect, it's possible that those 2 minutes and 30 seconds were among the most significant time periods of my life. K2 was a slightly pudgy 8-year-old from school, and she showed up at my house one day and said there was a dead rat in the alley, and being 8, I ran outside to see the dead rat, but instead, I found only her best friend, Amy, and Amy said, "Catherine likes you, and will you be her boyfriend?" And I said, "Yes." And then 8 days later, Amy showed up at my door again to say that Catherine didn't like me anymore and wouldn't be going with me from there on out. Catherine the Third was a perfectly charming little brunette, whom I met my first summer at Smart Kid Camp, which would, in time, come to be the place for child prodigies to pick up chicks. And since it makes a better story, I choose to remember that she dumped me one morning on the archery course after this math prodigy named Jerome ran in front of her bow and fell to the ground, claiming he'd been shot by Cupid's arrow. Catherine the Fourth, a.k.a. Catherine the Red, was a mousy redhead with red plastic-rimmed glasses, whom I met in Suzuki violin lessons, and she played beautifully, and I hardly played at all, because I could never be bothered to practice. And so, after 4 days, she dumped me for a piano prodigy named Robert Vaughn, who ended up playing a solo concert at Carnegie Hall when he was 11, so I guess she made the right call there. In 5th grade, I went out with K5, widely reputed to be the nastiest girl in school, because she always seemed to be the one who started lice outbreaks. And she kissed me on the lips out of nowhere during recess one day while I was trying to read Huck Finn in the sandbox. And that was my first kiss, and later that day she dumped me because boys were gross. Then, after a 6-month dry spell, I met Catherine the Sixth during my 3rd year at Smart Kid Summer Camp. And we went together for a record 17 days, and she was excellent at both pottery and pull-ups, two fields of endeavor at which I have never excelled. And although between us we could have made an unstoppable force of intelligence and upper body strength and coffee mug making, she dumped me anyway. And then came middle school, and the severe unpopularity commenced in earnest. But the nice thing about being on the near end of the cool curve is that periodically people will take pity on you, such as 6th grade's Catherine the Kind, a sweetheart who wore a frequently snapped training bra, and whom everyone called Pizza Face due to an acne problem that wasn't even that bad, and who eventually broke up with me not because she realized I was damaging what minuscule social standing she had, but because she felt that our month-long relationship had hurt my academic pursuits, which she believed to be very important. The 8th wasn't quite so sweet, and maybe I should have known it, since her name, Catherine Barker, anagrams into Heartbreaker Inc., like she's a veritable CEO of dumping. But anyway, she asked me out on a date, and then I said yes, and then she called me a freak and said I didn't have any pubes and that she would never seriously go out with me. All of which, to be fair, was true. K9 was in 6th grade, when I was in 7th, and she was by far the best-looking Catherine to date, with her cute chin and the dimples in her cheeks and her skin perennially tanned, not unlike you. And she thought that dating an older man might be good for her social status, but she was wrong. Catherine the Tenth, and yes, by then I had realized certainly that this was an awfully odd statistical anomaly, but I wasn't actively pursuing Catherine's so much as I was actively pursuing girlfriends, was a Smart Kid Summer Camp conquer, and I won her heart by, you guessed it, running in front of her bow on the archery course and claiming I'd been shot by Cupid's arrow. And she was the first girl I ever French kissed. And I didn't know what to do, so I sort of kept darting my tongue out from behind closed lips like I was a snake. And it didn't take very much of that for her to want to be just friends. K-10 K-11 wasn't so much a dating thing as a going to the movies once and holding hands and then me calling and her mother saying she wasn't home and then her never calling me back thing. But I'd argue that it counts due to hand-holding, and also due to the fact that she called me a genius. At the start of the second semester of ninth grade, a new girl showed up from New York, and she was as rich as they come. But she hated being rich and loved The Catcher in the Rye. And she said I reminded her of Holden Caulfield, presumably because we were both self-absorbed losers. And she liked me because I knew a lot of languages and had read a lot of books. And then she broke up with me after 25 days because she wanted a boyfriend who didn't spend so much time reading and learning languages. By then, I had met Hassan, and for about 10 years I'd had an obsessive crush on this brunette with blue eyes from school whom I'd always called Catherine the best. And Hassan played like Cyrano and told me exactly how to woo her, because, as we know from Katrina, Hassan is actually quite good at that stuff. And it worked. And I loved her, and she loved me, and it lasted for 3 months until November of 10th grade, when she finally broke up with me because she said, and I am quoting directly here, that I was both too smart and too dumb for her, which marked the beginning of Catherine's having ridiculous, idiotic, and frequently oxymoronic reasons for breaking up with me. A pattern that continued with the always clad in black Catherine the 14th, who I met that spring when she came up to me at a coffee shop and asked if I was reading Camus, which I was, and I said I was, and then she asked if I had ever read Kierkegaard, and I said I had, because I had. And then, by the time we left the coffee shop, we were holding hands and her phone number was in my brand new cell phone. And she liked to take me for walks on the lake shore, where we'd watch the waves crashing against the rocks on the shoreline. And she said there was only one metaphor, and that the metaphor was water beating against rocks. Because, she said, both the water and the rocks ended up worse off in the bargain. And then when she dumped me in the same coffee shop where we'd met 3 months before, she said she was the water and I was the rocks, and we were just going to keep going at each other till there was nothing left of either of us. And when I pointed out that, really, water doesn't suffer any negative effects whatsoever from slowly eroding the rocks on the lakeshore, she allowed as to how that was true, but dumped me anyway. And then, that summer at camp, I met K-15, who had the kind of puppy dog face with the big brown eyes and drooping eyelids that just sort of made you want to take care of her. Only she didn't want me to take care of her, because she was a very empowered feminist who liked me because she thought I was the great mind of my generation. But then she decided I would never be, and again I'm quoting, an artist, which was apparently cause for dismissal, even though I had never claimed to be an artist, and in fact, if you have listened closely, you have already heard me freely admit that I suck at pottery. And then, after a horrendous dry spell, I met Catherine the 16th on the roof deck of a hotel in Newark, New Jersey, during an academic decathlon tournament in October of my junior year. And we had about as wild and torrid an affair as you can possibly have over the course of 14 hours at an academic decathlon tournament. Which is to say that at one point we had to kick her 3 roommates out of her hotel room so we could make out properly. But then, even after I emerged from the tournament with 9 gold medals, I sucked at speech. She dumped me on account of how she had a boyfriend back home in Kansas, and she didn't want to dump him, so I was the next logical person to dump. Catherine the 17th, I met, I'm not going to lie about it, on the internet the next January, and she had a pierced nose with a ring in it, and had this immensely impressive vocabulary with which she was able to talk about indie rock. One of the words she used that I didn't initially know the definition of was, in fact, indie. And it was fun to listen to her talk about music, and one time I helped her dye her hair. But then she broke up with me after 3 weeks because I was sort of emo nerd and she was looking more for emo core. While generally I don't like to use the word heart unless I'm referring to the blood-pumping beat-beat-beating organ, there's no question that Catherine the 18th broke my heart, because I loved her immensely from the very moment I saw her at a concert Hassan made me attend during spring break. And she was this short, fiery woman who hated being called a girl, and she liked me. And at first, it seemed she shared my massive sense of insecurity. So I just built up my hopes ridiculously and found myself writing her these extravagantly long and painfully philosophical emails. And then she dumped me over email, after only 2 actual dates and 4 actual kisses,
whereupon I found myself writing her these extravagantly long and painfully pathetic emails. And just 2 weeks after that, Catherine I showed up on my doorstep, and soon enough she became Catherine XIX, and she was a nice girl with a good heart who liked helping people, and none of them ever lit my heart, God, I can't stop it with that word now, on fire like she did. But I just needed her so much, and it never felt like enough, and she wasn't consistent, and her inconsistency and my insecurity were this horrible match for each other. But I still loved her because all of me was wrapped up in her, because I'd put all my eggs in someone else's basket. And in the end, after 343 days, I was left with an empty basket and this gnawing, endless hole in my gut. But then, now I find myself deciding to remember her as a good person, with whom I had some good times until we both of us got ourselves into an ineradicably bad situation. And the moral of the story is that you don't remember what happened. What you remember becomes what happened. And the second moral of the story, if a story can have multiple morals, is that dumpers are not inherently worse than dumpees. Breaking up isn't something that gets done to you, it's something that happens with you. And the other moral of the story is that you, Smarty Pants, just told an amazing story, proving that given enough time and enough coaching and enough hearing stories from current and former associates of Gutshot Textiles, anyone can learn to tell a damned good story. Something about telling that story made my gut grow back together. What? Oh, nothing. Thinking out loud. That's who you really like. The people you can think out loud in front of.
The people who've been in your secret hiding places.
The people you bite your thumb in front of.
Hi.
Hi.
Wow. My first Lindsay.
My second Colin. That was fun. Let's try it again. Sold.
They left the cave together very late that night and drove home separately, Colin in the hearse and Lindsay in the pink pickup. They kissed once more in the driveway, that kiss as good as her smile hinted it would be, and then snuck into the house for a few hours of sleep. Epilogue, or the Lindsay Lee Wells chapter. Colin woke up exhausted to the rooster and rolled around in bed for a solid hour before making his way downstairs. Hassan was already sitting at the oak table with a collection of papers in front of him. Colin noticed that Hollis was not asleep on the couch. Maybe she actually had a bedroom somewhere.
Profit loss margins, Hassan explained. It's actually really interesting stuff. Hollis explained it to me last night. So, did you hook up with her or what?
Colin smiled. Hassan got up, grinning goofily, and smacked Colin on the back gleefully.
You're such a vulture, Singleton. You just circle, baby. You circle and you just slowly fly lower and lower, always circling, waiting for the moment when you can just land on the carcass of a relationship and fugging feast. It's a beautiful thing to watch, particularly this time, because I like the girl.
Let's go out to breakfast, said Colin. Hardee's?
Hardee's, agreed Hassan excitedly. Linz, get up, we're going to Hardee's.
Gotta go visit Mabel this morning, Lindsay called back. Eat 7 monster thick burgers for me, though.
Will do, Hassan promised.
So, listen, when I got home last night, I plugged Lindsay and me into the formula, Colin said. She dumps me. The curve was longer than K1, but shorter than K4. That means she's gonna dump me within 4 days.
Could happen. It's a crazy fugging snow globe of a world.
3 days later, the day, the theorem indicated, Lindsay and Colin would not survive together, Colin woke up to the rooster and rolled over groggily, only to find a piece of notebook paper against his cheek. It was folded in the shape of an envelope. And for once, Colin saw it coming. As he carefully unfolded the paper, he knew that the theorem's prophecy had been fulfilled, and yet
knowing it was going to happen made it no less horrible. Why? It's been so amazing. The best first 4 days ever. Am I crazy? I must be crazy.
As he opened the note, he was already debating whether to leave Gutshot immediately.
Colin, I hate to fulfill the theorem, but I don't think we should be involved romantically. The problem is that I'm secretly in love with Hassan. I can't help myself. I hold your bony shoulder blades in my hands and think of his fleshy back. I kiss your stomach and I think of his awe-inspiring gut. I like you, Colin, I really do, but I'm sorry. It's just not going to work. I hope we can still be friends. Sincerely, Lindsay Lee Wells. P.S. Just kidding.
Colin wanted to be all the way happy. He really did, because ever since he saw the steepness of the curve with Lindsay, he'd been hoping that it'd be wrong. But as he sat there on the bed, the note in his still shaky hands, he couldn't help but feel that he would never be a genius. For as much as he believed, Lindsay, that what matters to you defines your mattering, he still wanted the theorem to work, still wanted to be as special as everyone had always told him he was. The next day, Colin was feverishly trying to fix the theorem while Hassan and Lindsay played hold'em poker for pennies in the Pink Mansion's screened-in porch. A ceiling fan blew the warm air around without really cooling it. Colin was half paying attention to the game while scribbling graphs, trying to make the theorem account for the fact that Lindsay Lee Wells was quite clearly still his girlfriend. And then poker finally clarified the theorem's unfixable flaw. Hassan shouted,
"She's all in for 13 cents, Singleton. It's a huge bet. Should I call?"
"She does tend to bluff," Colin answered without looking up.
"You better be right, Singleton. I call. Okay, turn him over, kid. Gutshot Dolly has trip queens. It's a hell of a hand, but will it beat a full house?"
Lindsay groaned with disappointment as Hassan flipped over his hand. Colin knew nothing about poker, except that it was a game of human behavior and probability, and therefore the kind of quasi-closed system in which a theorem similar to the theorem of underlying Catherine predictability ought to work. And when Hassan turned over his full house, Colin all of a sudden realized. You can make a theorem that explains why you won or lost past poker hands, but you can never make one to predict future poker hands. The past, like Lindsay had told him, is a logical story. It's the sense of what happened. But since it's not yet remembered, the future need not make any fugging sense at all. In that moment, the future, uncontainable by any theorem, mathematical or otherwise, stretched out before Colin, infinite and unknowable and beautiful.
"Eureka," Colin said,
and only in saying it did he realize he had just successfully whispered. "I figured something out," he said aloud.
"The future is unpredictable."
Hassan said,
"Sometimes the kafir likes to say massively obvious things in a really profound voice."
Colin laughed as Hassan returned to counting the pennies of victory, but Colin's brain was spinning with the implications. If the future is forever, he thought, then eventually it will swallow us all up. Even Colin could only name a handful of people who lived, say, 2,400 years ago. In another 2,400 years, even Socrates, the most well-known genius of that century, might be forgotten. The future will erase everything. There's no level of fame or genius that allows you to transcend oblivion. The infinite future makes that kind of mattering impossible. But there's another way. There are stories. Colin was looking at Lindsay, whose eyes were crinkling into a smile as Hassan loaned her 9 cents so they could keep playing. Colin thought of Lindsay's storytelling lessons. The stories they'd told each other were so much a part of the how and why of his liking her. Okay. Loving. 4 days in and already, indisputably, loving. And he found himself thinking that maybe stories don't just make us matter to each other.
Maybe they're also the only way to the infinite mattering he'd been after for so long. And Colin thought, because, like, say I tell someone about my feral hog hunt, even if it's a dumb story, telling it changes other people just the slightest little bit, just as living the story changes me, an infinitesimal change. And that infinitesimal change ripples outward, ever smaller but everlasting. I will get forgotten, but the stories will last. And so we all matter, maybe less than a lot, but always more than none. And it wasn't only the remembered stories that mattered. That was the true meaning of the K3 anomaly. Having the correct graph from the start proved not that the theorem was accurate, but that there's a place in the brain for knowing what cannot be remembered. Almost without knowing it, he'd started writing. The graphs in his notebook had been replaced by words. Colin looked up then and wiped a single bead of sweat from his tanned, scarred forehead. Hassan turned around to Colin and said, "I realize the future is unpredictable, but I'm wondering if the future might possibly feature a monster thickburger." "I predict it will," Lindsay said. As they hustled out the door, Lindsay shouted, "Shotgun!" And Colin said, "Driver!" And Hassan said, "Crap!" And then Linz ran past Colin, beating him to the door. She held it open for him, leaning up to peck his lips. The brief walk from the screened-in porch outside to the hearse was one of those moments he knew he'd remember and look back on, one of those moments that he'd tried to capture in the stories he told. Nothing was happening, really, but the moment was thick with mattering. Lindsay laced her fingers in Colin's hand, and Hassan sang a song called, "I love the monster thick burger at Hardee's. For my stomach, it's a wonderful party." And they piled into the hearse. They'd just driven past the general store when Hassan said, "We don't have to go to Hardee's, really. We could go anywhere." "Oh, good, because I really don't want to go to Hardee's," Lindsay said. "It's sort of horrible. There's a Wendy's 2 exits down the interstate in Milan. Wendy's is way better. They have, like, salads." So Colin drove past the Hardee's and out onto the interstate, headed north. As the staggered lines rushed past him, he thought about the space between what we remember and what happened, the space between what we predict and what will happen. And in that space, Colin thought, there was room enough to reinvent himself, room enough to make himself into something other than a prodigy, to remake his story better and different, room enough to be reborn again and again. A snake killer, an archduke, a slayer of talks, a genius even. There was room enough to be anyone. Anyone except whom he'd already been, for if Colin had learned one thing from Gutshot, it's that you can't stop the future from coming. And for the first time in his life, he smiled, thinking about the always coming infinite future stretching out before him. And they drove on. Lindsay turned to Colin and said, "You know, we could just keep going. We don't have to stop." Hassan in the back leaned forward between the seats and said, "Yeah, yeah, let's just keep driving for a while." Colin pressed down hard on the accelerator, and he was thinking of all the places they might go and all the days left in the summer. Beside him, Lindsay Lee Wells' fingers were on his forearm, and she was saying, "Yeah, God, we could, couldn't we? We could just keep going." Colin's skin was alive with the feeling of connection to everyone in that car and everyone not in it. And he was feeling not unique in the very best possible way. Acknowledgements. 1. My incomparable editor and friend, Julie Strauss Gable, who worked on this book when she was, literally, in labor. I rely so much on Julie's editing that, this is a true story, I once made her edit an email I wrote the woman with whom I was then just friends and with whom I am now living in holy matrimony. Which reminds me. 2. Sarah. See dedication. 3.
my mentor and collaborator and alter ego and BFF, Eileen Cooper, who was responsible for most of the good things that have ever happened to me. And also, come to think of it, helped me woo acknowledgee number two. 4. My dear friend Daniel Biss, who fortunately for me is one of the best mathematicians in America, and also one of the best teachers on the subject. I could never have imagined this book without Daniel, let alone written it. 5. My family, Mike, Sydney, and Hank Green. 6. Sarah Shumway, my very talented in loco editoris at Dutton. Also everyone else at Dutton, particularly Margaret Double Letters Woollett. 7. My man in the United Arab Emirates, Hassan Al-Rawas, who has been providing me with Arabic translations and his wonderful friendship for many years now. 8. Adrian Loudermilk. 9. Bill Ott. 10. Lindsay Robertson. 11. Shannon James and Sam Hallgren. 12. David Levithan and Holly Black. 13. Jessica Tuchinski. 14. Brian Dorries. 15. Levin O'Connor and Randy Riggs. 16. Rosemary Sandberg. 17. Book List. 18. All Librarians Everywhere. And of course, 19. The Catherines. I wish I could name them all, but A, I lack the space, and B, I fear the libel suits.
We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of An Abundance of Catherines by John Green. Copyright 2006 by John Green. Read by Jeff Woodman. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Corey Young. Performance copyright 2006 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.